Okay, we're starting here at the bottom of Lamed Vavam and Bed, but the two dots. The Gemara here is about to discuss the latter half of the Mishnah that says, Milamdo Midrash Halachot Vagadot. Someone who is Mudar Hana'a, the individual has the right to teach them Midrash Halachot Vagadot. Avalo Yilamdenu Mikra. But he may not teach him Torah Shebichtav. So Gemara asks the obvious question, which is, Mikra, my taima lo yilamdenu. Why can't he teach him Mikra? Why can't he teach him Torah Shebichtav? Mishum digamahamenile. Because he is giving hana'a. By teaching him, he's providing with a certain amount of hana'a, which would be a violation of the neder, and therefore he can't teach him. Gemara says, Midrash nami kamahanile. How is that any different than Torah Shebaalpeh? Torah Shebaalpeh should also be subject to the same restriction. Amar Shmuel, Shmuel says, "B'makom shenotlim schar ala mikra, ve'notlim schar ala midrash." It's a location where they have different minhagim. They have a minhag with regards to Torah Shebichtav, with regards to the mikra, where they do take compensation, and they have a minhag with regards to Torah Shebaalpeh, where they do not take compensation. So Shmuel says that that's the minhag makom. And based on the minhag makom, that will have impact in terms of what type of benefit is he providing this individual by teaching him. If he's teaching him mikra, he foregoes the salary or the schar that he's entitled to, then he's giving hana'a to that individual. On the other hand, if there is no salary involved, meaning that by Torah Shebaalpeh we teach without any salary, then in that case, by foregoing the salary, there was no salary to forego, and therefore there is no iser hana'a associated with it. Gemara asks a very simple question, my Pascal, how do you know? Shmuel is saying that this is a place that has such and such a minog. Where did he come up with this idea, or how does he know that the place has such a minog? So Gemara says, Hakamashvalan, Dafilu b'makom shnotlim schar ala mikra shari in the mishkal, ala midrash lo shari the mishkal. The Mishnah is teaching you as a derivative din, which is that even in places where they have the minog to pay for teaching, they only are allowed to pay for teaching with regards to Mikra, with regards to Torah Shebichtav, but Ala Midrash by Torah Shebaalpeh, Lo Shari the Mishkal, you don't have such a right to collect compensation for teaching Torah Shebaalpeh. So the Gemara basically takes Shmuel's din, or how he's explaining the Mishnah, as being a place which has a custom to pay for Mikra, and does not have a custom to pay for Gemara, or for Torah Shebaalpeh, and then basically says that that is the codified law, which is that even in places where you take schar, the only place that you can take schar is Torah Shebichtav and not Torah Shebaalpeh. But then the Gemara comes back to the basic question, which is Mishnah, Midrash, Delo. Why is it by Torah Shebaalpeh or by Drashot that you do not take compensation for teaching? Dichtiv, because the Pasuk says, Votitzi Vashem Beitahi Lamedetchem. So Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshat Devarim says to Bnei Yisrael, "Voltitzi v'Hashem v'etil lamedetchem chukim u'mishpatim lasotchem otam ba'aretz asher etem ovrim shem alerishta mishmartem mod nafshutechem k'lo ritem kol tmuna b'yom diber Hashem aleichem b'choreiv mitoch ha'esh." So Moshe Rabbeinu says that "Voltitzi v'Hashem," Hashem commanded me at that time, "Lelamedetchem," to teach you chukim u'mishpatim, to teach you the chukim mishpatim, in order that you should be able to keep them and do them in the land that you are going into. A little bit before that, within that same parsha, it says, "Re'ei, limadeti etchem chukim u'mishpatim kashet tzivani Hashem Elokai. I taught you the chukim mishpatim like Hashem commanded me. Asod kein b'kerev aretz ashetem vayim sham alevishta, to keep them and to uphold them in the land that you are coming to inherit." So ma'ani b'chinam. So here the Gemara brings the drasha, which is a fundamental drasha with regards to teaching of Torah. Ma'ani b'chinam, afatem nami b'chinam. Just like I am for free, so too you have to be for free. There are different ways to explain this. The way that the Ran explains it is that the connection between the two psukim that are quoted by the Gemara, which is, the Gemara says that, "Rei nimarti etchem chukim u'shvatim kasher tzivani Hashem," like Hashem commanded me. What exactly did Hashem command Moshe over here? If you're telling me that he commanded him to tell him this information, that's no chiddush to tell me kasher tzivani Hashem. So what is the kasher tzivani Hashem modifying? And that's what the Ran says over here, that the kasher tzivani Hashem is modifying the receipt of compensation, that Hashem commanded me to provide you the lessons of the Torah, and that I may not take any compensation for providing you with those lessons. Kasher tzivani Hashem, klomar shetzivani lemod bechinam. Hashem commanded me to teach for free. Dilo, if that was not the case, then the kasher tzivani amai koi. What is it going on? Delekan meimar bischar deecha lema kasher tzivani. You can't say it's talking about receiving compensation, because then why would say Hashem commanded me like this? V'chitzi v'obakach? When did Hashem command him about this? V'sagya delo dishkol agro? It's not okay for him to teach without taking compensation? And you can't say that Kasher Tzivani is coming to teach you Kasher Tzivani velo matzmi ani omer. It's not that I heard this from Hashem and I'm not saying this of my own volition. I'm not making this up. So we're not so worried about this issue. Because they believed in Moshe Rabbeinu, and they trusted Moshe Rabbeinu to only bring them the word of Hashem. That means, Kasher Tzivani, the way Hashem commanded me to teach for free. So that's the way that the Ran learns it, that the Kasher Tzivani is the pivotal piece of the Psukim over here. And that's Kasher Tzivani teaches me that you have to do it b'chinam. Tosafot, seemingly using a similar type of drasha as the Ran, says the reason that it must be the case is because Mistama Moshe lo natal schar Mizrael shashir hava. Moshe Rabbeinu was extremely wealthy, and therefore he didn't have any need to take money or compensation for teaching Torah. So it wasn't that he was commanded not to take schar, not to take compensation for teaching Torah. Rather, it was completely unnecessary. And so that's what Moshe says, mani b'chinam, afatem b'chinam, just like I taught, without taking any compensation, you will have to teach without taking any compensation. The Rosh gives a slightly different explanation, which is the focus on Hashem, which is Tziva uti lelamed etchem bechinam. Hashem commanded me to teach you for free. Kamo shehu lamdeni bechinam. Just like he taught me bechinam. And so that's the parallel here. Just like Hashem taught Moshe Rabbeinu al Har Sinai bechinam, so to you, Moshe Rabbeinu, in passing on that Mesorah, you also have to teach bechinam. Here you have three different approaches to the Psukim. We have the Ran, who's saying it's focused on the Kasher Tzivani. The Balei HaTosafot, who say that it's just a result of the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu was extremely wealthy. And then you have the Rosh, who suggests that Hashem sets the paradigm by which the conveyance of Torah is determined. Just like Hashem taught Bichinam, so too Moshe Rabbeinu was required to teach for free. And so too, anybody else who teaches Torah Shebal Peh has to teach for free. The Gemara says,
and as the Ran notes over here, with regards to the teaching itself, there's no problem in terms of the Mudah Hana'ah, because the Limud itself is a mitzvah. And since it's a mitzvah, mitzvot lav le'enot nitnu. And therefore, if the person has to teach for free, so there was no foregone compensation, he's doing a mitzvah, and mitzvot lav le'enot nitnu, and that's what makes it permissible to teach this individual who is Mudar Hana'ah, Midrash Halochot Vagadot, Torah Sheba'al Peh.
If that's the case, then Mikra Nami Bechinam, then why isn't Torah Shebichtav also done Bechinam if Moshe Rabbeinu conveyed that to Bnei Yisrael, either Bechinam or Hashem conveyed it to him, Bechinam?
So then why is Torah Shebichtav different than Torah Sheba'al Peh? It should be subject to the same rules as Torah Sheba'al Peh. And the Gemara answers over here, Rav Amar Schar Shimur, V'Rabbi Yochanan Amar Schar Pisuk Te'amim. So here we have a Machloket Rav and Rabbi Yochanan, but it centers around the fact that the compensation that is received by Torah Shebichtav, or teaching of Torah Shebichtav, is not for the teaching of the Torah itself, that is subject to the same rules as Torah Shebaal Peh. But rather, the compensation over here is for not the learning itself or the teaching itself, but for something on the side that happens simultaneous with the learning. One possibility is, and that's Rav's position, Schar Shimur, that you are babysitting, which the Rosh describes over here as Shelo Yelechu B'Rechovot U'B'Shukim. They shouldn't go out in the streets and in the marketplaces, Ve'Yaziku, and they will cause damage, V'Yechanchu D'Dvarim Ra'im, and they'll end up being educated in street behavior, poor conduct, and therefore there's what to be gained here from not only the limud itself, but the fact that they are not doing what would have been the alternative with their times if they were not here in this classroom setting or learning with this Rebbe. While you are teaching these children Torah, you are also babysitting them. And so you can charge for the babysitting, even though you cannot charge for the teaching of the Torah. On the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan says that you can charge for the Pisuk Teamim, which is either the pronunciation trup, which would be the punctuation of the psukim, which is not the core, the essence of the limud, but rather a mesorah as to the proper way to read the psukim. Now, the machloka between them seems to be on two levels. Number one is the maturity of the individuals who are being taught over here. According to Rav, it's pretty clear that we're talking about individuals who are of an age that do require shimur babysitting, whereas Rabbi Yochanan seems to think that that's not the issue, and there's a possibility here of receiving compensation, even if the individuals are more mature. The other thing that they argue about, and we'll see that on the Amud Bet today, is this Pisuk Tamim, as to whether Pisuk Tamim is something min haTorah, or is Pisuk Tamim something midrabanan, or a minhag that was noeg later on. And therefore, if it is only something that is a minhag that's nahug, then you can charge for it. On the other hand, if it's min haTorah, then it would be no different than the chukim u'mishpatim, which when one teaches them, he may not charge for them. The same would be true by the pisuk tamim.
Tznan, our Mishnah. Lo yelam denu mikra. You're not allowed to teach him Torah shvichtav. Bishlum alaman damar schar pisuk tamim. According to one who says the reason that you can take compensation by Torah shvichtav is because of pisuk tamim, haino de lo yelam denu. Then it makes sense in our Mishnah here why you can't teach him Torah. Alaman damar schar shimur. According to the individual who says that the compensation, the money that's being paid here, is for the fact that he's babysitting or taking care of the children. Mar says, Gadol Bar Shimurhu? Wait a minute. Since when are people of age or people who are not youngsters requiring babysitting? So then how do you charge for teaching Torah Shebichtav to adults if in those adults are self-reliant or self-policing and they don't require your effort in order? So here we have seemingly a nafkamina between these two positions. So that's what the Gemara says here. If you believe the problem here is pisuk tamim, then I understand. But according to the one who says that it's for schar shimur, then it's not relevant with regards to a gadol.
And our Mishnah seems to be talking about a case of a gadol. And therefore, it would only be relevant to be compensated for pisuk tamim. It would not be relevant to be compensated for schar shimur.
So Gemara says, v'katan ktani. Gemara says, no, the Mishnah is talking about a case of a katan. Where it says, Ibe Katan, if you're really talking about a Katan, Ema Seifa, what are you going to do with the latter half of the Mishnah of Amalameh, that Banav Mikra, you can teach his children Torah Shbichtav, Katan Bar Banimo? If the party to the Mishnah is a Katan over here, then how can the latter half of the Mishnah say that we're talking about his kids? How does he have kids if he's a Katan? Says, Achsure Mechzer of Akritani, this is what you have to say. Lo Yilam Denu Mikra Be Katan, shouldn't teach you a Mikra when he's a Katan. Imaya Gadol Milamdo Lo Ulovanav Mikra. On the other hand, if he is a Gadol, and he has children who need to be educated, then in that instance, he can educate them without a problem.
Because the individual himself as a gadol is not subject to schar shimur, and therefore there's no foregone compensation, and you can teach him. As far as his children are concerned, that we discussed in the Mishnah, permissible to teach them either because there's no obligation for the parent to pay for the education of their children, or the parent could find someone to teach the children without having to compensate, and therefore you're not providing any benefit over here to the parent by teaching the children. And once again, the teaching of the Torah itself is considered to be a mitzvah, and mitzvot lav lehenot nitnu.
What they just did was split the Mishnah up and said the first part of the Mishnah was talking about a katan, a minor, and the second half of the Mishnah was talking about a case of a gadol. That's how it makes the transition from the first half of the Mishnah, which must be talking about a katan in order to be that he can take compensation for teaching Torah Shebichtav, to get to the gadol, because it mentions the gadol, and then it mentions the children of the gadol. Meitave, tinokot lo korin b'tchila b'shabbat. Eloshonim Birishon. The youngsters do not have shir on Shabbat, or basically they don't start a new sugya, they don't begin to read a new thing on Shabbat. Eloshonim Birishon. But rather they go over, they do chazara over what that which they have learned.
Even though it might be the first time that they are chuzer over the material that they had learned before. And the reason it is impermissible for them to learn a new sugya on Shabbat, the Tosafot says, Mipnei Oneg Shabbat, and the Rosh expounds on that and says, Im hayu korim b'tchila, haya chamur lahem, v'hayu tzrichim la'arich, they would have to go on for a long time, v'avot mitzapim lisod ad shiyavo, the parents, the fathers are looking forward to eating with their children, u'mavatlin oneg Shabbat, and therefore they postpone, delay, or ruin the Oneg Shabbat by becoming involved in a difficult topic or a new topic which will bog down these young children.
According to one who says that it's Chai Pisuk Tamim, now I understand why you don't start doing that on Shabbat. Why can't you start reading something new on Shabbat? And why are you doing Chazara even first time? I mean, your first time of Chazara you can do. Ha'ika Schar Shimur de Shabbat. You still have the problem that there is Schar Shimur over here.
The assumption being that if the compensation here is for Pisuk Tamim, then the Ikar compensation is the first time that you teach it. After that, it's just a review of the material. So therefore, the primary compensation has to do with the first time that you're learning it. And that's why you're not permitted to learn it for the first time on Shabbat, because that would engender compensation for teaching on Shabbat or working on Shabbat. But if it's only for Chazara, that's not considered to be the main part of the compensation, and you don't have to worry about it. On the other hand, if you think that the compensation has to do with the babysitting, then why should it matter whether you're learning it for the first time or you're Chazaring? The same benefit of babysitting these children is equally applicable to the first time they learn something as to the second time they learn it, as well as the time that they are chuzer on it. And then, if that's the case, you are getting compensating for working on Shabbat, and that's considered to be schar Shabbat and would be problematic. So therefore, it's very difficult to understand this if you believe the reason that you're getting compensated over here is for schar shimur.
Marzez v'litameich, schar pisuk Shabbat mi'asur. Since when is the schar from Shabbat asur to start with? Havla ahi. It is subsumed under a greater package of compensation which does not delineate Shabbat separately. And when you subsume the compensation for Shabbat in a bigger pot of compensation, that is mutar.
That is most likely a derivative of the fact that the Isur here of Skar Shabbat is not an Isur of Malach on Shabbat, rather a Din Derabbanan of performing Mecha Chomemkar on Shabbat. So if you do something like Havla'ah, which takes away the aspect or the obvious aspect of Mecha Chomemkar, over there the Chachamim were matir such an arrangement on Shabbat because it's only a Chashash Dirabanan, and by doing it through Havla'ah, in a sense you've covered up or blocked the view of this as being Mecha Chomemkar, and therefore it's no longer a problem on Shabbat.
Titania, so cheta poelish mor etatinok. These are all instances where out of the public coffers we support these individuals, which is you can hire somebody to watch over the tinok. If you remember in Yerushalayim that the wealthy women used to have their children be born and stay in a specific place so they never had any associations with Tuma in order that they could be participants in the Para Aduma. So that's one case. The other case is Shmor et para. They hired someone to watch over the para, to watch over the para duma, or the shmor et hazra'im, someone to look over the produce. Ein notim lo schar Shabbat. In all of these cases, you can't give him schar Shabbat because he's a day laborer. And if he's a day laborer, then when it comes to Shabbat, he can't demand payment on that day because then that becomes schar Shabbat. Lefikach, based on that, im abdu enu chayav b'achrutam. They get lost, he's not responsible for them. If he was a sechir for a week, sechir chodesh, or he was a month-long hiree, sechir shana, he was hired by this individual for the year, sechir shavua, or for 7 years, noten lo sechir shabbat, and you're allowed to give him sechir shabbat, because that's what's called havlah. It's included in the bigger picture of what's happening over here.
So what you see from this breita, this tosefta from Shabbat, is that there's a difference in the way that one is compensated. If one is compensated on a daily basis or as a day laborer, then there is a problem in terms of Schar Shabbat. And therefore one would not be permitted to take compensation for their work on Shabbat because each day stands on its own. Therefore, in an instance where it's lost on Shabbat, he would not be responsible for it. Since he may not take compensation for Shabbat, he becomes a Shomer Chinam on Shabbat, and a Shomer Chinam is Patur from Gneva Ve'aveda. On the other hand, if the compensation is done through habla'ah. It's included in a much bigger package, whether that means that he's compensated on a weekly basis, a monthly basis, an annual basis, or a multi-year basis, then Shabbat is not specifically getting compensated for. It's a compensation for the whole package, which happens to include Shabbat in it. In that case, he is a Shomer Sachar around the clock. And then it gets lost on Shabbat. He'll be responsible because he's no longer a Shomer Chinam on Shabbat. He's actually a Shomer Sachar. And a Shomer Sachar is Chayav in Gneva Ve'Aveda. Now, as to when something is considered to be Habla'ah, subsumed under the greater payment rather than having Shabbat delineated, how does that work? Does it mean that you have to specify an amount for the entire week or for the entire month and not give any daily enumeration of the compensation because that would delineate Shabbat separately? Or is it just the fact that more than Shabbat is included in this compensation? Yes, you're paid daily by a daily rate, but you are hired for the whole week. And because you're hired for the week, we don't focus on the Shabbat in particular. That might be the difference in the phraseology that's used here by Rashi versus Daran. Rashi says over here, "Shenotim lo zayin pshitim scharo l'shavua, hafo bishim agia liyom Shabbat pashut echad." He gets 7 coins, 1 coin for each day. So it's clear that he's getting compensated for Shabbat. But the fact that it's done as a package makes it all right. On the other hand, the way that the Ran explains it is, "Amaya schir Shabbat." Shavuachat. It's compensation for the entire week. There's no separation or deletion of the day itself. So some read between Rashi and Daran a nafkamina in terms of what they consider to be havla'ah. According to Rashi, it's simply that there's a multi-day payment, even though each day has a fixed amount of compensation. On the other hand, for Daran, it's got to be a weekly payment that doesn't in any way segregate any of the days or specify the payment for any of the days. Then if that is the case, there should be no difference between whether you're getting compensated for Schar Shimur or whether you're getting compensated for Schar Pisuk Tamim. Either it's impermissible because you're getting compensated for Shabbat itself, or it should be permissible because you're getting compensated b'havla'ah in a total package of compensation that includes not just Shabbat, but all the days of teaching or all the days of babysitting. Therefore, we're going to have to come up with a different reason as to why one may not start a new sugya on Shabbat and only may be chozer even if it's the first time that they're doing chazara on Shabbat.
So then what's the reasoning behind why you don't start learning something new with the kids on Shabbat? Mishum di'ifnu avathon di'enoke le'mitzvoto.
De'shabto.
That their fathers should be free in order to perform the mitzvah of Oneg Shabbat. So that's formulated slightly differently by different Rishonim over here. Rashi says over here that if we do this, Hayu Trudim Behen, they'd be bogged down by this learning. Vayu Pnuim, the mitzvot Shabbat, Litanegbo. They wouldn't be free to enjoy the pleasures of Shabbat. That's the way that Rashi describes it over here. Tosafot says, Shielahem Panai, that they'll have free time. Shepnuim l'sudat Shabbat, that they'll have the opportunity to partake in sudat Shabbat because they have sufficient time to participate in sudat Shabbat. And the Ran over here says the reason being that v'mishtashrim imatinokot, that the parents or the fathers play and enjoy the company of their children. V'mikaru atinokot chatchilo, if the tinokot go off to school and they're learning a new subject, echushu levitulam. Then it'll be the case that they'll stay too long or they'll be engaged for too long, and that will cause their parents from not having that opportunity to enjoy their presence. So whatever the reason being here with regards to not starting a new sugya on Shabbat, the main issue is that it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort to accomplish it. Somehow, that is causing a diminishment in the Oneg Shabbat. Whether that's the Oneg Shabbat of the child themselves, whether it's the Oneg Shabbat of the father and the enjoyment of playing with his children, or if it's just simply that they'll have the opportunity to eat, then in all of those instances, we say that we don't want to keep them in the Beit Midrash on Shabbat for too long because we're going to cause, or it's going to come at a much larger cost than simply them being in the Beit Midrash. The other possibility is, mishum that on Shabbat they eat and drink, alma, and they become slightly ill or weighed down by the food that they consume over Shabbat, k'da'amar Shmuel, like we have the famous saying of Shmuel, shinu veset tchilat cholei me'ayim. When a person changes their regular course, and therefore on Shabbat, where they eat large meals, what their body is not used to, that change from the normal dynamic of the week causes them to feel ill or slightly sick. And because of that, we don't want them engaged in deep learning or difficult learning on the morning of Shabbat, because they're not going to have the physical strength or wherewithal to do it, because the fact that when they eat on Shabbat and they have all that extra food and that change of schedule, that'll cause them to feel a little weighty, not of such a clear mind. Therefore, it'll be difficult for them to concentrate or participate in the learning of the sugya for the first time, because they are burdened with the difficulty in the change of their normal schedule, which makes them physically weaker and more distracted and unable to concentrate or focus on starting a new sugya. L'manda mar schar pisuk tamim, according to one who says that it's because of schar pisuk tamim, my time alo amar schar shimur. Why doesn't he hold like the other opinion that says that it's for babysitting? Kasavar banot mikabayin shimur? Do daughters require shimur? Number of assumptions made over here. The first of which is that kasavar banot mikabayin shimur, that the banot were also being taught in some manner. The fact that they're being taught would not be sufficient for him to get paid, because they don't require shimur. They don't require guarding. The Ran here brings an alternate girsa from Banot as to gadol, that a gadol does not require shimur.
So if the reasoning here is schar shimur, that's only relevant to a particular subset of individuals that you are teaching. It means young males who require shimur. In that instance, you're entitled to compensation. Otherwise, it wouldn't be relevant, either because the banot are much better behaved or are less likely to get themselves into trouble. Or we're talking about a gadol who doesn't require shimur at all. In those instances, you couldn't get compensated. And so therefore, he says this is a very narrow concept of allowing for compensation for teaching mikra. And that's why I don't think that that's the right reasoning behind what we're saying over here.
Mandamar schar shimur. My time alone, my schar pisuk tamim. According to one who says you get compensation for babysitting, why didn't he say that you get compensated for the pisuk tamim? The savar pisuk tamim doraito. He thinks that pisuk tamim is bina Torah. If it's bina Torah, then it's subject to what we began the Gemara with, which is the chukim and mishpatim that Moshe Rabbeinu brought down, the chukim and mishpatim and these items, and he taught them bechinam. And therefore, you're also required to teach them bechinam because they're a dinaim doraito. Whereas if they were only dinaim derabanan, then you wouldn't have that same requirement. What is meant by the pasuk in Nehemiah? Vayikru'u v'sefer b'torat ha'elokim miforash v'som seichel v'yavinu b'mikra. So now the Gemara dashes. Vayikru'u b'sefer torat ha'elokim ze mikra, that is the mikra itself. Miforash ze targum. The explanation is the targum, which translates it and makes it understandable. The som seichel elaha psukim. These are the psukim themselves, the breakdown of the psukim. Ve'avinu b'mikra ze pisuk ta'amim. That is the pisuk ta'amim, whether that means the punctuation, whether that means the trump, but that's a pisuk ta'amim. But you see over here that it's derived from the pasuk in Nehemiah, which means that it's likely a din d'oraita, not a din d'rabanan. Ve'amri lo, but there's an alternate opinion, says elo amistorot. That last piece of the pasuk, which we darshan to mean pisuk tamim, which is vayavinu mikra, really is vayavinu b'mikra, that is the misorot.
Olinyan halocha, as the Ran points out over here, when we have a machloket Rav and Rabbi Yochanan, halocha ki Rabbi Yochanan, which would mean the reason that you can be mikabel schar for mikra is because of pisuk tamim. That would first of all mean that we are indifferent as to whether they are ktanim or gdolim, because pisuk tamim is equally applicable to them. Number two is, it would imply that pisuk tamim is only midirabanan and not midirabanan. In addition, the Ran points out that we also can pass an halacha that when it comes to limud Torah with midrash, halacha, and gada, or Torah Shebaal Peh, one is not mutar to take compensation. It's asur to get compensated for teaching Torah, aside from this issue of pisuk tamim, which is associated with Torah shebichtav. Well, then, how do people get compensated for teaching Torah? So the Ran hints at it here in mentioning, Aval agar batala shari. But one may get compensated for their schar batala, which is the fact that they are leaving other opportunities. They are giving up other jobs with compensation in order to teach. And that's what entitles them to payment or compensation over here. We learned that in Daf Kuf Hei, in Gemara Ketubot, as to the nature of schar batala and how one would calculate or what makes it into schar batala. Is it simply that this person is giving up some opportunity, or does it have to be a very specific opportunity? Does it have to be clear and present payment that they can take compensation for? That we learned in the Gemara in Ketubot. And we also learned from the Gemara in Bechorot, which is the main sugya with regards to getting compensating for being a judge, doing a mitzvah, or teaching of Torah. And as we mentioned in those places, it is a machloket rishonim as to whether it is appropriate for one to take schar batala for the teaching of Torah, or is that only a situation of bidiavad? With the Rambam taking a very strong position against taking compensation for teaching Torah, versus other rishonim who are much more open to that idea, as well as the discussion as to what alternative employment the individual must have in order to be allowed to collect on the schar batala. So all of these come together with our sugya over here, the sugya in Ketubot and Bechorot, to determine how one may be compensating for teaching Torah, as well as the permissibility of kolel or taking compensation for one's learning of Torah. In addition, over here, with regards to a person getting hana'ah from the individual teaching Torah, there might be two things to focus on in addition to what we've said until now, which is number one, even if the individual pays for the Torah that's being taught, for instance, in a case where they're teaching Torah Shebichtav, an individual is entitled to ask for compensation because of Schar Pisuk Tamim. Nevertheless, even if the individual pays for it, he may not be able to utilize this teacher. And that has to do with the sugi that we saw earlier with regards to Mekach Memkar. When it comes to transactions, if the transaction is an at-marketplace transaction, then we deem both the Mocher and the Koneh, both the buyer and seller, to be beneficiaries of such a transaction. So if you're paying this individual the proper compensation for their teaching, that might not be enough to rid yourself of the problem of getting hana from this individual. It might be that if you overpay them, in that instance, maybe it would be permissible. In addition, from yesterday's Gemara, we saw that in a principal-agent relationship, if the principal asks an agent to act on his behalf and the agent acquiesces and does act on his behalf, the mere fact that the agent listened to him is sufficient to deem it hana'ah. And so too over here, with regards to teaching of Torah, if an individual asks another party to teach them Torah, maybe even if they're going to pay for it, that might be problematic, not because of the hana'ah, that is, the foregone compensation to this individual, because by Torah Shebichtav there is no compensation, or even by Torah Shebichtav where he does make compensation to him, there might be a problem of simply the fact that you asked him to do it, and he's responding to your request. That might be enough hana'ah to deem it improper in the case of a person who is mudar hana'ah.
And what are the misorot? I'm Rabbi Yitzhak, mikra sofrim, vitur sofrim, vikaryan velo ktivan, uktivan velo karyan, halacha l'moshe misinai. So here we have a list of items that are considered to be misorah, and that's what the pasuk is referencing, not necessarily the pisuk ta'amim. Now, the latter ones are easier to understand. Halacha l'Moshe Misinai, again, that's an oral tradition from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu that tells us some sort of halacha. The case of Karyan Velo Ktivan, you're reading them even though the words do not appear in Tanakh, or the opposite, Uchtivan Velo Karyan. The words are present there in the Pasuk, but we just don't pronounce them. So those three are easy to understand. It's the first two that are much harder to understand, which is, what is this Mikra Sofrim? And what is this Itur Sofrim? So the guards to Rashi says Mikra Sofrim. Mikra Sofrim is the Misora to look at Vina Nahavara, that we don't write out the syllabization clearly. So Rashi points out some words here, like Eret, where truthfully, if you wanted to spell it out correctly, so the pronunciation of the syllabization would be correct, you'd write Aleph Yud, Resh Yud, Tzadi Sofit. Because then the A sound and the Ret sound would be helped by the Yud. And that would be Eretz. And he says the same thing by other words. He goes through a whole bunch of other words where we pronounce letters or we pronounce vowels and we don't have those letters or vowels inside of the word. How do we know that? Misora. That's what the Misora is about. So that's the way Rashi interprets Mikra Sofrim. On the other hand, the Rosh says that the din of Mikra Sofrim is how to pronounce words in certain circumstances or situations. Which again, we're going to see in a second, the Gemara is going to give an example of that, which is the fact that if a word is found at a Tanachta, or a word is found at a Sof Pasuk, and the letters had a segel under them, the first letter of the word had a segel on it, for instance, Eretz, in that case, would turn to Aretz. If it was the last word in the Pasuk, or it was the word by the Etnachta, it would change the word itself, Itur Sofrim, which again is a very difficult thing. We'll get to some of the examples and then try to explain it there. But Itur Sofrim seems to be some sort of poetic license that allows you to either interpret or write the words in a certain way, even though maybe that's not the optimal way to write it or necessarily understand the way that it's written. So Gemara now gives examples of each of these. Mikra Sofrim, Eretz, Shemayim, and Mitzrayim. So now, according to each of the opinions, now you have to understand what this means. According to the Rosh, who said before that when you have a word with a segel in it, by the Etnacht or the Sof Pasuk, it changes from Eretz to Aretz. Okay, so you explain the word Eretz. But what does that have to do with Shemayim and Mitzrayim? Those words aren't relevant then. There's no change in Shemayim and Mitzrayim. So if you look in the Balei Tosafot, said that's not true. They say that a segel changes to a kamatz when you're at an etnacht or a sof pasuk, that sometimes a patach turns into a kamatz as well. So therefore, shamayim would turn into a shomayim at the etnacht or the sof pasuk, and the same thing with mitzrayim, but a patach would turn into mitzroyim at a etnacht or a sof pasuk. So there's actually a change. It's not from segol to kamatz, but rather from a patach to kamatz by shamayim and mitzrayim. The Ran, on the other hand, brings that the mikra sofrim by eretz means eretz versus aretz, and shamayim and mitzrayim is the way that we pronounce the yud with the chirik under it. We don't add in, or like Rashi suggested before, add a syllabization, whether that's the aleph that would be between the shin and the mem, shamayim, or mitzrayim, which would include an additional either syllable or understanding of what the syllable should be in that case, or whether it means that the yud itself with the chirik under it, pronounce it as shamayim as if there's an aleph there, and we do not pronounce it as shamayim as the yud sound that's there. So how can we make that switch? He says that's mikra sofrim. That is a mesora as to how to pronounce certain letters and vowels in different contexts. Itur sofrim. So here is the example of itur sofrim. Achar tavoru. Achar teleich. Achar te'asef. Kidmo sharim. Achar nognim. So in all these cases, it seems to be that you're talking about order. Achar is after, kidmu means before. The Ran claims that the problem here, or the reason the Itur Tosafim, is that these words are completely extraneous. The word achar, or the word kidmu, in each of these instances was not necessary or not relevant, but it was left in or was put there because of Itur Sofrim, because it makes it prettier, say more poetic and nicer language with it in, even though it doesn't bring any additional meaning to the situation. So that's one way to explain what this Itur Sofrim is over here. The Rosh over here says, Achar Tavoru, Hayraoi Lichto Bevav. There should have been a Vav there. Dahava Mashma, Sa'adu Libchem, Ve'achar Kach Tavoru. And then only afterwards should you leave. And that when he's offering them food and is telling them to come in, he says, please stay or tarry a little bit, eat by me, and then afterwards you will continue on your journey. When you say, v'achar tavoru, only then should you go on the journey, then it seems to make sense that the modification of the achar is on the tavoru. On the other hand, without the vav there, it makes it sound like, sadu libchem achar tavoru. You should only eat after you've gone past, after you've left here already. So the question of how the achar fits in, and the Ran mentions something along these lines, which is, where is the pisuk? Where is the stop? Is it achar and then tavoru? Or is it achar tavoru? The difference being whether it's a statement that after you've done whatever's beforehand, then do this, or is it telling you that you should only do this after That's it. Only once you pass by should you eat. And that would be clarified by a vav. But we don't put the vav in there because it's itur sofrim. Something that either the vav wouldn't look good, wouldn't sound good in that context, or it's a poetic license of sorts with regards to the Torah. Tzidkatecha k'harekel. The Ran mentions, another Rishonim mentioned that it seems like the kafa demyom is extraneous or unnecessary. It should have just said tzidkatecha harekel. Why does it say k'harekel? So he says that kaf, that kafa demyom, is unnecessary, and that's what's itur sofrim, to make it look nice, to make it more presentable. Kayan v'lok tivan. I'm going to give you examples of psukim that are read, but not written. Meaning that the words are absent in the psukim, but you still read the pasuk even though the word is absent. Now the truth is, with regards to Kri and Ketiv, the majority of Kri and Ketiv that are found in the Torah are about a single letter. Maybe one letter, maybe two letters. What the Gemara is clearly doing over here is not bringing examples of every Kri and Ketiv in the Torah, but rather what it's bringing examples of instances where the entire word is missing. It's a Kri and Ketiv where the whole word is affected by it. So here you have the story by Shmuel Bet, Perichet, where it talks about the exploits of David HaMelech and all the places that he conquered. It says, Vayach David et Hadad Ezer ben Rechov Melech Tzova belechto lashiv yado b'Nahar Prat. When he was going to put his hand back in Nahar Prat, that word Prat is pronounced, but not written in the Pasuk. It's a Karyan v'lok Tivan. It's read, but it does not appear in the Pasuk. So even though the word Prat makes sense in the Pasuk, and we're talking about, if you look there in the Pasukim, talking about him fighting by Aram up in the north, then it makes a lot of sense that he's by Nahar Prat, just that the word Prat doesn't appear. But there's a Mesorah that we pronounce it or we say it even though it doesn't appear. The next example that the Gemara brings is from Shmuel Bet, Perek Tet Zayin, with regards to the merit of Shalom, and the fact that Achitofel joins the merit of Shalom, and then when Avshalom refuses to take his advice at the end of the war, it says, "Vatzat Achitofel asher ya'atz bayamim ahem, kasher yish'al ish bedvar lukim." Any advice that Achitofel gave was the equivalent of asking God. It was the equivalent of going to God. That's how right he was. That's how clear his thought process was. Cain kolatzat Achitofel gam le David gam le Avshalom. So too was the advice that he proffered to David and Avshalom, that he was always correct or he was always right, because he was like the Dvar Elokim, his word. And now in that Pasuk, Kasher Yishal Ish, the word Ish is pronounced even though it's not written in the Pasuk. Next example that the Gemara brings is from Yirmiyahu. It says, Hine yamim ba'im ne'um Hashem, v'nivne ta'ir la'Hashem imigdal chananel shara pina. So there is a promise or an indication that in the future, the city of Yerushalayim will be rebuilt. And over there it says, Hine yamim ba'im. The word ba'im is read even though it does not appear in the Pasuk itself. The next example again is from Yirmiyahu. It says there, Hashmiu el bavel rabim kodorche keshet chanu alea saviv al yihi la pleita. Shalmula kepala v'sher asta asula kikel Hashem zadai el kadosh Yisrael. Yirmiyahu is describing the fact that the people are going to be destroyed or punished, and they're going to get what they deserve because of all the bad and all the terrible things that they had done. But again, in that pasuk it says chanu aleh saviv al yihi la pleita. So that la again is pronounced even though it doesn't appear there. The next examples are from Megillat Rut, which seems to be replete with incidents of this. The only problem is, the Gemara thinks it's a lot more replete than our Megillat Rut is. Which is that now the Gemara is going to give an example, which we do not have. It says there, et taged hugad. The word eight, vayhaged hugad, has this same phenomenon that it's not written there, but we do pronounce it. The only problem is, if you go to our Megillat Rut, we don't have anything of the sort. The word et is written there, and it's clearly, it's not that there, it's not written and we pronounce it, it's completely there in the pasuk. It says, Vayan Boaz, Vayomer la, Haged hugad li, kol asher asit, et chamutech, achrei mot ishech, v'tazvi avich, v'imeich, v'eretz molatech, v'telchi el am, asher yadat, Tmol Shilshom. So over there, the word et appears in the psukim, and it's not missing. Then we have another example from Megillat Rut, which is the Eli of the Goren, and then there's the Eli of the Seorim. So that example by Megillat Rut, it says, "Vatomer Elea kol asher tomri Eli eseh." That's what Rut says to Naomi when Naomi is giving her advice to go to approach Boaz. Says that Rut responds to her and says, "Kol asher tomri, whatever you say." Whatever you say to me, as sir, I will do. The word Eli over there does not appear in the Pasuk, yet we do pronounce it as if it was there. And then the final example that the Gemara brings is, Vatomer Shesha Sarim Eile Natan Li, Ki Amar Eli Al Tavoy Rekam El Chamotech. After the incident at night with Boaz, he sends her back with food to her mother-in-law. And again in that Pasuk it says, Ki Amar Eli. Because Boaz said to me, the word Eli also over there does not appear in the Psukim, is added in, even though it's not written in the Psukim. Those are all examples of Alein, Karyan, Velok Tivan. Those are examples of things that are read, even though they're not written down in the Tanakh. Uch, Tavan, Velok Karyan. What are examples of a case where it's written down, but we do not read it? So here the Mara goes through a number of examples. The first one is the Na of the Yislach, which is Naaman. When he comes to get cured from his tzorat from Elisha, he tells Elisha on the way back that davar zeh yishlach Hashem l'avdecha, that Hashem should forgive me for this. Bevor aduni beit rimon lishtach avot shem, when I go back home to my job as the sar tzava, v'hu nishan al yadi, and then the melech at that time is going to lean on me, v'shtach aveti beit rimon, I'll have to bow down there. Hashem should forgive me for doing this. I'm not doing this because I don't believe in Hashem. I'm not doing this because I want to worship Avodah Zarah. I'm doing it because I'm compelled by my position to do it. But in my heart, I don't want to be bound down. Over here, the Pasuk says, Islach na. So even though the word na appears in the Pasuk, we do not pronounce the word na. Then the Gemara gives the example of Zota Mitzvah, which is very problematic. It's in Devarim Perek Vav, which says, "V'zota mitzvah, chukim v'mitzvotim, asher tzivah Hashem l'kechem l'omed etchem, l'asot ba'aretz asher atem ovrim shama l'rishta." Well, the Gemara over here seems to indicate that the zot there in the pasuk is not pronounced, but if you look in that pasuk, everything in that pasuk is pronounced. There's no kri and there's no ktiv to be found. You can see that Rashi says, "Zota mitzvah is ktiv b'Yirmiyah." That's written in Yirmiyahu. Or, in other words, the Pasuk is not the Pasuk that we think from Dvarim Vav, but rather there's an alternate source for the Pasuk, and you can see that in Haggot Ha'Ruah, he says, Nimchak v'nirei b'inai et dahanefesh, that it's not Zot HaMitzvah, but rather the et of nefesh that should be there, and that is another example. Then the next case, right, the Quran says that it's B'seder et Hanan, and then he says, V'lo mitzvah b'sfarim shalom, and then I can't find it. I mean, once he says it's going to be in Etchanan, then he's going to obviously have a very hard time finding it because we don't have anything like that in Etchanan. So Rashi says that it was a different location, and same with the Gra, makes it possible that we have the wrong Mesoras, that what's written over here is not an example, but rather there's an alternate example. Then the next incident is a case in Yirmiyahu again, which says, Al Yidroch Hadorech Kashto Va'al Yit'al B'Sir Yino Ve'al tachmalu el bachurei acharimu kol tzva'a. So there it says, al yidroch hadorech. Again, the word in between them is al yidroch, and it's repeated again, the word yidroch, and then hadorech. So that second yidroch is almost in parentheses, basically taking it out. Even though it's written, we do not pronounce it. Chamesh to pa'at negev. The five from pa'at negev in the description of the Bayit HaShlishi in Yechezkel. It says over there that Upat Negev Chamesh Meot V'Arba'at Alafim. Upat Kadim Chamesh Meot V'Arba'at Alafim. Upat Yama Chamesh Meot V'Arba'at Alafim. So the word Chamesh, in first instance, Upat Negev Chamesh, that the word Chamesh is written twice over there, even though we only pronounce it, because that's what it says here, Chamesh Upat Negev. And then Techi Goel, the last example that is brought is from Rut again, which is, in the case by the leveret marriage of Ruth, it says, Vata, kiamnam, kiim, goel anochi, v'gam yesh goel karov mimeni. That Boaz affirms Ruth that yes, he is a goel, but there is a party or family member that's closer to her than him, and he would have the first right of refusal or the first ability to take her as a wife. So Halein, these are all examples of Ktavan Velo Karyan, things that are written in the Torah, but they are not read. So even though they're written there, they're not read. Now, the Grom points out down below, if you look in the Grom, I go to Grom with Aleph, he says, Ubis Sifreinu Od Gimel. In our Sfarim, we have another three examples of this. And then he goes on to list them. By Amnom, by Im De Makom, and Im De Kasher. So another three examples of words that are written in Tanakh that we do not pronounce whatsoever. And the Ran also brings examples like that. So it seems here that the list that we have is not exhaustive, at least with regards to the things that are Ktivin, but not Karyin, that we do not read it. So there are other opportunities or examples that the Ran brings, but here our Gemara brought either a sampling of those examples, or examples that they thought were the most important of those examples. Amar of Acha Barada Bimarova, Paskin Adain Psuka Letlata Psukin. We break up this Pasuk into three different parts. It seems we break it up into three parts. Whether that means that they punctuate it in such a manner that it breaks it up into three parts, or whether it literally means that they split the pasuk up into three different psukim, but it's clear that they had a different misora in terms of how to work with that pasuk than the standard misora that we have. Okay, we're going to stop here. Six lines down on the top of Lamed Chet Amud Aleph.